I'll maybe start this way. We generally think of like capitalism having phases. There was like the classical imperialist phase. Then there was the phase between the wars. Then after World War II, there was the Fordist or Keynesian phase. And then in the 70s or 80s, we had the beginning of the neoliberal phase of capitalism. Between these phases, there's always a period of give or take 10 years of hegemonic transition, where there is no stable way, or even temporarily stable way, to arrange capitalism, where it lurches from one crisis into another, where political actors do not seem to have any plans or projects, any realistic ideas of how to solve these crises. Right now, you have interlocking financial, political, social, military, ecological crises. And none of them can be solved. Nobody has any good idea for how to solve the climate crisis. Nobody has any good idea for how to solve the Syria crisis. Nobody has any good idea for how to recreate political legitimacy, political systems that are becoming less and less stable because fewer and fewer people actually trust in these political systems. And there is nobody who has any idea for how to solve the economic crisis. Sometimes we think that, okay, the financial crisis is over, but actually there's no real new, what in academic speak is called new regime of accumulation. There's no new driver of growth. If you look at the economic press, you get terms like there's a cash glut. There's lots and lots of money that can't be invested productively. So there's all this just money sloshing around the global economy. So this situation of multiple interlocking and non-solvable crises can be called a period of hegemonic transition, where capitalism transitions to another relatively stable phase. My favorite theorist, Antonio Gramsci, referred to it as an interregnum. Interregnum is a term to describe a historical period between two kings or monarchs. And Gramsci said, this interregnum is a time of monsters where the old has died and the new cannot yet be born. And therefore, it's a time of monsters. There are no real formed out plans for how to get out of these crises. And that's, I would say, the situation we find ourselves in right now. We're in a classical interregnum where neoliberalism has kind of come to an end. It cannot generate enough profits anymore. It cannot generate enough social legitimacy anymore. But there's also nothing new. Nothing is pushing neoliberalism off the world stage. It's like a zombie. Neoliberalism is like a zombie that stumbles about, still kills everything in its sight. But it's not off the world stage yet, because nothing has emerged to push it off this stage. And the final point is that this time, capitalism cannot use its key way to normally get out of crisis, which is just to restart a new round of growth. Not only because nobody knows where this new round of growth might come from, China tried, but that didn't really work, but also because the ecological crisis makes growth a real problem. More growth means more ecological crisis, means more war, means more conflict, means more insecurity, which in turn means less economic growth. So that's the situation we're in right now. We're in a classical interregnum or hegemonic transition period, but nobody has any idea what might come after this.
Thank you. And what about question number two? How will climate change develop in the near future? What is your... how do you see that?
Well, I mean, this is kind of, I already kind of led into that. Climate change is definitely going to escalate. We already have all these extreme weather events, you know, starting in the public attention, and we remember things like Hurricane Katrina, Hurricane Sandy, because they happened in the US. But there's like hurricanes, droughts, floodings, these extreme weather events, which cannot individually be referred back to climate change, but climate change massively increases the likelihood of them happening. We've already been seeing those for the last few years. Climate change is going to escalate in terms of shifting weather patterns, which in turn means screwing up agricultural growth patterns, basically sedentary agriculture. Our ability to grow food for lots of people in stable ways depends on stable growing periods. You need, you know, the crops that are grown in Germany, they need winter, spring, summer, autumn, and again and again and again. That's how our agriculture systems have developed. Climate change in the medium term is going to develop in such a way that it'll become ever harder to even plan when to plant your crops, because you will not have stable weather patterns. So what you'll see in the short term is warming of oceans, more floods, more typhoons, more disasters of this kind. But in the medium term, and we're talking possibly 30 to 50 years, it's actually possible that the whole global climate system is going to tip from a stable to an unstable state. And just imagine what a world would look like in which you don't know whether June is going to be full of ice or full of heat. It will fuck up agriculture, and if agriculture is screwed up, then everything else gets screwed up pretty quickly.
And what about the connection between capitalism, climate change, and immigration? How do you see this triangle?
Well, I'll start with the first bit, capitalism and climate change. So the single most useful variable, if you want to take any given year in the past, if you want to know how much the level of greenhouse gas emissions grew in that year, you know what the one thing is that you want to look at? How much did the world economy grow that year? Like, that is the absolute closest connection. If you want to explain the growth of greenhouse gases in the world's atmosphere, then the single basic explanation is the growth of the world economy. Now, I'll make a little bracket around the kind of Eastern European, or rather the sort of I'll make a bracket around the state communist systems that we saw from 1917 to broadly 1989. They were pretty shit about the environment as well, but that's another question why that happened. So I'm not greenwashing them at all or whitewashing them, but that's another question. Historically, climate change starts when we see the beginning of industrial capitalism. And so just in terms of historical time, the connection's really tight. When capitalism starts, we start changing the climate. And that is because capitalism was historically driven by fossil fuels. And fossil fuels are always the key driver of climate change. Also, if you look back into the past, the only periods in world history, or in the history of the last 250 years, where greenhouse gas emissions actually dropped was when you had an economic crisis, so when the capitalist economy didn't grow all the time. And therefore, basically the connection is clear. If you have a growing world economy, then you're going to get a growth in greenhouse gas emissions. And capitalism is a system that needs to constantly grow. Even the people who like capitalism say that the great thing about it is its internal dynamic, the fact that it keeps on growing. It never stops. The problem is that you can't have, or if you have infinite growth on a finite planet, at some point something's going to go bang, and that something is the climate. Now, so to get to the second question, traditionally people who talked about climate change, if this were 15 years ago, I'd probably like be holding up a fuzzy polar bear and be like, hey, there's these polar bears and they're all dying because there's no more ice in the Arctic. But of course, climate change isn't just about polar bears. In fact, I think a lot of the kind of world or the northern world realized that in 2005, when Katrina hit the United States, hit New Orleans, when the Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, because there we, for the first time, saw what had been a reality in many parts of the global south already, which is that actually, when climate change disasters hit, it is always the poor who have contributed least to climate change who suffer first and who suffer most, because the rich tend to have the resources to protect themselves from climate change. So, now we get to the question of immigration. Climate change doesn't always just happen as a big disaster. Very often, it does happen just to sort of like gradual increases or reductions, by the way, in temperature. There's not a linear phenomenon. Climate change can also mean that it gets colder in some parts of the world and much hotter in others. But so climate change can work in like gradual changes of temperature. And those in turn can lead to desertification, which you see in sub-Saharan Africa a lot. Like there's a lake in Nigeria, which used to be a huge lake. Now it's almost gone. But there used to be whole economies around this lake. You had fishing economies, you had hunting economies, you had agricultural economies based around this lake. Now the lake is gone. What do you think, and it's gone because of climate change, what do you think the people who used to hunt and fish around that lake are doing today? Do you think they still live there in a dry patch of dust? Of course they don't live there anymore. Of course they have moved elsewhere. They have become migrants. And not usually. Usually in Europe we tend to think about migration as something where folks cross from Africa to the Mediterranean and come here. Most migration is domestic, happens within the same country or the same region. So climate change has already displaced millions and millions and millions of people, largely but not only in Africa. And that, of course, means migration. Displaced people are migrants. And there's a really important connection that exists right now between the many Syrian refugees and migrants who are coming to Europe, and even the more millions of Syrian refugees who are staying in the region but leaving Syria. And the connection is, and their situation in climate change. So basically, there was a massive drought in Syria from 2006 to 2010, and that led to massively increasing grain prices, and that in turn made it harder and harder for people to survive in their villages, and so they went into the cities, which in turn drove this whole conflict, like rapid urbanization, which is driven by climate change, was driving the conflict, which in turn led to this whole mess that then generated the refugee crisis. Now, this may sound a little complex, but it is complex. Climate change doesn't linearly affect the world, but it tends to amplify every single injustice that's out there. And if you're already living a tough life at the edge of your, you know, at the edge of just making the ends meet, and then climate change just, you know, just screws up that one harvest, it may destroy your entire livelihood and turn you into a migrant. And so that's capitalism, climate change, and then immigration. And then, of course, we get back to sort of like the structures of a world in chaos that I described at the beginning. Right now, the fact that there is no... The fact that there are so many conflicts and crises in this world right now makes it ever harder to also deal with this massive migration. For example, Germany was easily able to take in huge numbers of migrants during the 50s and 60s because it had a booming economy. And, you know, everything was fine. The industry was growing. And sort of countries that are not in deep economic crises tend to have an easier time taking in refugees than others, or migrants. So actually, the chaotic state of global capitalism also makes it harder for us to deal with this issue of migration.
About exploitation, oppression, what would you say in concrete ways? How do we experience these two things nowadays? How has it changed in the current state of global capitalism? How do we experience in our everyday lives exploitation and oppression?
I mean, it's a really interesting question, because traditionally I would say, so you essentially have two kinds of capitalist growth. One is through exploitation, when workers produce something and they get paid less than the value of their work, and that's the profit of the capitalism. That's exploitation. Oppression is maybe something slightly different, where, you know, oppression is when somebody comes and hits you over the head and takes something that you have. But actually, that's also a reality of global capitalism. In fact, neoliberalism, a very important Marxist theorist called David Harvey, referred to this as accumulation by dispossession. Basically, where capitalists just make a profit by taking things from people, not necessarily stealing them, but, you know, starting political processes like privatization, which are, you know, a political equivalent of stealing. So if the first is exploitation and the second is oppression, I would say at this point, in this current moment in capitalism, both are happening in an escalating way. So exploitation is, of course, happening through the precarization of life and of labor relations. It's becoming ever harder for folks to kind of hold on to stable jobs. Folks have to work more and more hours. Their wages are wages per hour are dropping, and ever more of social wealth is accumulating at the top. So that's classic exploitation, and this is sort of experienced as a as increasing the precarity of life. But I think there's also just still very classic oppression. I mean, we haven't even started talking about the wars that we are already seeing in the world and that will be escalating as this hegemonic transition period kind of deepens. And so I would say that right now it's actually a toss-up if there's worse exploitation or oppression in the world. I wouldn't even be able to say, but I think that both are very important features of the way capitalism is organized right now. The future of getting organized within emancipatory movements. Okay, well, I'll start like this. Sometimes if you look at this whole question from the environmental or climate justice perspective, it's actually really quite depressing. And I'm saying this because things are already very bad, and they're getting worse quickly. And sometimes it seems like there is no way that we can stop all this chaos, that we can stop the destruction of the environment, which is a phenomenon which, as I said before, tends to affect those the most who have done the least to cause it. And sometimes, you know, you just organize, you go to these group meetings, you organize demonstrations, and you write newsletters, and you hand out flyers, and you put up posters, and sometimes it seems kind of a bit pointless, because the scale of the challenge is such, it's so vast. You're like, how can we possibly win? Now, and I'd say two things about that. And the first one is, social movements have a miraculous quality. And I say miraculous, and I mean there's something, in the strong sense, wonderful about it. And that is that social movements extend the limits of the possible. Like, in any given social situation, you could say, hey, it's like in January 1989, no serious political analyst would have said that, in summer of 1988, no serious political analyst would have said that 2 years later, all the sort of governments of Eastern Europe will have fallen. That was impossible. That was objectively impossible until social movements made it possible. A smaller scale example, gay marriage in the US. 5 years ago, everybody was like, man, that issue is poisoned. You know, Republicans here, Democrats there, nothing is moving. Today, the whole country has basically gone over to gay marriage. Like, even the Republican Party, actually, on most levels. That was impossible. Social movements made it possible. So the first thing I'd say is, that's the amazing capacity of social movements to do things that political systems consider impossible. And that is my experience in social movements. That was my very first experience with social movement at the anti-WTO protests in Seattle in 1999, where everybody said, hey, neoliberalism, nobody can challenge that, that's the end of history. And then we just shut down that summit for a day, and suddenly other worlds became possible where that didn't seem possible before. So that's my first point. Even if the challenge seems huge, social movements can change what's possible, and that's what is needed right now. And the second thing I would say is, and this may seem kind of defeatist, but it's important to be realistic about these things as well. Even if we lose, so from a climate perspective, even if we don't manage to prevent the climate from tipping and things going really crazy, being involved in a social movement is still the absolute best thing you can do. Like, the kind of intensity of connections, the knowledge exchanges, the solidarities that you build up there are the single best way to build what environmentalists call resilience, like an ability to withstand external shocks. And whether it's kind of whole countries going fascist, which, you know, we're seeing in the European right now is an eminently realistic possibility, or a massive environmental catastrophe, this is going to be my last point, Take what happened when Hurricane Sandy hit New York a few years ago. You know who the first people were who were providing emergency relief? That was not the government. That was actually activists who had become politicized in the Occupy movement. Because they actually knew about solidarity and about sticking together and about not trusting, not like expecting somebody else out there to take care of the thing. We're going to do this as communities here, as people. We're going to help each other. So either, you know, things go to shit, but even then, being involved in a social movement is the best thing you can do to survive, you and everybody around you. Or we win, in which case, great, we've won. So either way, whether things are going to go shit or whether we win, being involved in a social movement is still the best thing you can do.
So we live in a world where climate change is changing our planet and the way of lives of people. And it's the era that we live in, it's called Anthropocene. It says that it is the human era where human beings actually are affecting the climate and the planet as much as never before. But the question is this Anthropocene the era of human beings, or is it the era of capitalism? So you could actually say that it is the era of capitalism. A lot of researchers points out that we are not in the era of human beings. We are in an actual era of capitalism. For example, Andreas Malm from Lund University. And when you look at the issue from that perspective, then you see that we live in the era of climate change and capitalism. And what is going on right now is that a lot of people have to move because of the effects of climate change. For example, people that I met that are pastoralists in Kenya that had been living in a very dry place for ages and for generations, they know how to adapt to droughts. They know if it doesn't rain for one or two or three seasons even, they know how to find water. They know how to dry meat so that they have some food when the next drought comes. But what is happening now is that the droughts are coming more and more often, and they cannot adapt anymore. So it makes them actually to have to move. So already today, when we just have 1 degrees of warming, we have a lot of people that are already climate refugees. And that is a whole degree below the actual 2 degree level that the scientists and people are talking about that we cannot go over. So capitalism, global change, climate change and migration are very connected to each other. For example, you can see the big the big amount of refugees coming from Syria. Now we're talking about like millions of Syrians that are fleeing their home. And a lot of people didn't talk about one of the root causes to this problem, which was the drought in Al Jazeera region in Syria. Of course, that's not the only root cause, but one of the root causes. And what the state did when the drought came on wasn't to plan and to help pastoralists or farmers to be able to live where they used to live. So a lot of people, 1.5 million Syrians, they went from the countryside into the cities. And where did they go? Yeah, into the slums. And if you see how the Syrian economy works, it's just like all over the world. It's a capitalist system. And where you have to sell your body and sell your work to get some money to eat. And that's what 1.5 million farmers actually did. But not with what they've been doing for the last 100 or 200 years or generations, but what they had to do in that situation where they didn't have anything left. They just lived in the slums. And when that happens, when a lot of people comes and a lot of other people lives there and unemployment rises and food prices rises and water is scarce, so you have this problem where suddenly there is a lot of pressure on the system. And of course, this is one of the big routes to the uprising in Syria and what happened after that. And now we see those people that were affected here in Europe. I live in Malmo in southern part of Sweden, and a lot of Syrians and other migrants have been coming here. And when I've been writing about climate change as a journalist for the past years, I never thought that I would see climate refugees in my lifetime. But what we are actually are seeing is that people are fleeing their home where they have been living for a long time, for generations, where they actually didn't want to leave because of climate change. And you can say, actually, that climate change is one of the effects of global capitalism. So, yeah, migration and capitalism are really linked.
And how do you see the near future of this picture, of this big story? What will happen in the near future concerning these issues?
The other side of the coin is that advanced capitalist states are closing their borders. They're doing everything to close borders for people that really need protection. For example, Syrians or Ethiopians that are fleeing from the big drought. So what's happening, for example, in Sweden right at the moment is that the Swedish government decided to close its borders so that people that are coming to Sweden that want to go to Finland or to Norway are stopped at the border in Denmark, and they're pushed back and back and back. And this is because the borders around Europe is not working as good as they want it to be. So that's the other coin of capitalism. Now that we actually destroyed people's livelihoods, destroyed the places where they want to live, where they have their language, their networks, their culture. When they come here, suddenly we are going to stop them. Even though that our advanced capitalist states are the ones that can give them protection and that has room for people to actually come and live and have a decent life.
And what would be the most positive resolutions for the situation could happen?
The thing is that the people that are affected by climate change, first and foremost, are not the people that had any cause They are not the people that that are affected by climate change, first and foremost, are not responsible for causing climate change. So these are people, poor people in the periphery of the world, and they are very affected, and they don't have the adaptation means that we have in northern parts of the hemisphere. For example, look at the sea level rise in Egypt. It's really affecting the farmers there. And look at the sea level rise in Holland, where they actually can stop it for a bit, for a longer while than actually Egypt can. So all these people, they don't have a responsibility, but the rich countries does, and we have also a historical responsibility. So one of the resolutions would be to actually pay off our debt to these people, to say that, yes, you are welcome here. We are opening our borders because we destroyed your livelihoods. We destroyed your lives. And it's on us that is happening. The global climate change is happening. It is because of us and because of what we have been doing for centuries. So one of the reasonable things and the best things would be to actually open the borders, say, yes, we will take in the people that are affected, that need protection. But just to remind you that all the research on migration says that when people flee, they flee for a short period or for a short distance because they always want to go back. So what we're seeing, that the people that are actually coming, the refugees that are coming to Europe, is a very, very tiny bit of all the refugees in the world. For example, all the Syrians that are coming to Sweden said, oh my God, we cannot take 100,000 Syrians or 100,000 refugees. But there are 2 million refugees in Turkey from Syria and 1 million in Lebanon and so on. So, yeah, the reasonable thing would be actually to open our borders and to just let people have the protection that they are entitled to.
And what about the dystopian picture, if everything goes wrong and bad, and how do you see, like, the worst scenario of the near future.
I have a 16-month-old baby, and I don't really want to think about how it will be when it's 3 degrees warmer. It's really hard for me to try to think about that. And I feel that it's all our responsibilities to actually do something so that we don't get there. Because after Paris, we have this deal and all this voluntarily reductions of emissions, and it leads us to a 3 degrees warming of the world, and that would be a catastrophic scenario, of course. But what the hope I found in Paris was the movement, of course, the movement in the US that has been closing down hundreds of coal mines for the past years, or the Keystone XL pipeline, or that the movement pressured Shell so much so they're not drilling in Arctic after oil and gas anymore, or Ende Gelände in Germany that Taju is a part of. So really, I try to focus and think about that, the movements and the hope in that, instead of trying to think about the dystopian scenario.